This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For further information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Andy Minter. The Warden by Anthony Trollope. Chapter 17. Sir Abraham Haphazard. Mr. Harding was shown into a comfortable inner sitting-room, looking more like a gentleman's book-room than a lawyer's chambers, and there waited for Sir Abraham. Nor was he kept waiting long. In 10 or 15 minutes he heard a clatter of voices speaking quickly in the passage, and then the Attorney-General entered.
"Very sorry to keep you waiting, Mr. Warden," said Sir Abraham, shaking hands with him. "And sorry, too, to name so disagreeable an hour. But your notice was short, and as you said today, I named the very earliest hour that was not disposed of."
Mr. Harding assured him that he was aware that it was he that should apologise. Sir Abraham was a tall, thin man, with hair prematurely grey, but bearing no other sign of age. He had a slight stoop in his neck rather than his back, acquired by his constant habit of leaning forward as he addressed his various audiences. He might be 50 years old, and would have looked young for his age, had not constant work hardened his features and given him the appearance of a machine with a mind. His face was full of intellect, but devoid of natural expression. You would say he was a man to use, and then have done with, a man to be sought for on great emergencies, but ill-adapted for ordinary services, a man whom you would ask to defend your property, but to whom you would be sorry to confide your love. He was as bright as a diamond and as cutting, and also as unimpressionable. He knew everyone whom to know was an honour, but he was without a friend. He wanted none, however, and knew not the meaning of the word in other than its parliamentary sense. A friend? Had he not always been sufficient unto himself? And now, at 50, was it likely that he should trust another? He was married, indeed, and had children. But what time had he for the soft idleness of conjugal felicity? His working days or term times were occupied from his time of rising to the late hour at which he went to rest, and even his vacations were more full of labour than the busiest days of other men. He never quarrelled with his wife, but he never talked to her. He never had time to talk, he was so taken up with speaking. She, poor lady, was not unhappy. She had all that money could give her. She would probably live to be a peeress, and she really thought Sir Abraham the best of husbands. Sir Abraham was a man of wit, and sparkled among the brightest at the dinner-tables of political grandees. Indeed, he always sparkled, whether in society, in the House of Commons, or the courts of law. Coruscations flew from him, glittering sparkles as from hot steel, but no heat. No cold heart was ever cheered by warmth from him. No unhappy soul ever dropped a portion of its burden at his door. With him success alone was praiseworthy, and he knew none so successful as himself. No one had thrust him forward, no powerful friends had pushed him along on his road to power. No, he was Attorney-General, and would in all human probability be Lord Chancellor by sheer dint of his own industry and his own talent. Who else in all the world rose so high with so little help? A premier, indeed. Who had ever been premier without mighty friends? An archbishop? Yes, the son or grandson of a grand noble, or else probably his tutor. But he, Sir Abraham, had no mighty lord at his back. His father had been a country apothecary, his mother a farmer's daughter. Why should he respect any but himself? And so he glitters along through the world, the brightest among the bright, and when his glitter is gone, and he has gathered to his fathers, no eye will be dim with a tear, no heart will mourn for a lost friend.
"And so, Mr. Warden,"
said Sir Abraham,
"all our trouble about this lawsuit is at an end."
Mr. Harding said he hoped so, but he didn't at all understand what Sir Abraham meant. Sir Abraham, with all his sharpness, could not have looked into his heart and read his intentions.
"All over. You need trouble yourself no further about it. Of course they must pay the costs, and the absolute expense to you and Dr. Grantly will be trifling. That is, compared with what it might have been if it had been continued.
I fear I don't quite understand you, Sir Abraham.
Don't you know that their attorneys have noticed us, that they have withdrawn the suit?
Mr. Harding explained to the lawyer that he knew nothing of this, although he had heard in a roundabout way that such an intention had been talked of. And he also at length succeeded in making Sir Abraham understand that even this did not satisfy him. The Attorney-General stood up, put his hands into his breeches pockets, and raised his eyebrows as Mr. Harding proceeded to detail the grievance from which he now wished to rid himself. "I know I have no right to trouble you personally with this matter, but as it is of most vital importance to me, as all my happiness is concerned in it, I thought I might venture to seek your advice." Sir Abraham bowed, and declared his clients were entitled to the very best advice he could give them, particularly a client so respectable in every way as the warden of Barchester Hospital. A spoken word, Sir Abraham, is often of more value than volumes of written advice. The truth is, I am ill satisfied with this matter as it stands at present. I do see, I cannot help seeing, that the affairs of the hospital are not arranged according to the will of the founder.
None of such institutions are, Mr. Harding, nor can they be. The altered circumstances in which we live do not admit of it.
Quite true, that is quite true. But I can't see that these altered circumstances give me a right to 800 a year. I don't know whether I ever read John Hiram's will, but were I to read it now, I could not understand it. What I want you, Sir Abraham, to tell me is this. Am I, as warden, legally and distinctly entitled to the proceeds of the property after the due maintenance of the 12 beadsmen? Sir Abraham declared that he couldn't exactly say so in so many words that Mr. Harding was legally entitled to, etc., 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 and ended in expressing a strong opinion that it would be madness to raise any further question on the matter, as the suit was to be, nay, was, abandoned. Mr. Harding, seated in his chair, began to play a slow tune on an imaginary cello.
"Nay, my dear sir," continued the Attorney-General, "there's no further ground for any questions. I don't see that you have the power of raising it."
"I can resign," said Mr. Harding, slowly playing away with his right hand, as though the bow were beneath the chair in which he was sitting.
"What, throw it up altogether?"
said the Attorney-General, gazing with utter astonishment at the client. "Did you see those articles in the Jupiter?" said Mr. Harding piteously, appealing to the sympathy of the lawyer. Sir Abraham said he had seen them. This poor little clergyman, cowed into such an act of extreme weakness by a newspaper article, was to Sir Abraham so contemptible an object that he hardly knew how to talk to him as a rational being.
"Hadn't you better wait," said he, "till Dr. Grantly is in town with you? Wouldn't it be better to postpone any serious step until you can consult with him?"
Mr. Harding declared vehemently that he could not wait, and Sir Abraham began seriously to doubt his sanity.
"Of course,"
said the latter,
"if you have private means sufficient for your wants, and if this—"
"I haven't a sixpence, Sir Abraham," said the warden.
"God bless me! Why, Mr. Harding, how do you mean to live?"
Mr. Harding proceeded to explain to the man of law that he meant to keep his precentorship, that was £80 a year, and also that he meant to fall back on his own little living of Crabtree, which was another £80. That, to be sure, the duties of the two were hardly compatible, but perhaps he might effect an exchange. And then, recollecting that the Attorney-General would hardly care to hear how the service of a cathedral church is divided among the minor canons, stopped short in his explanations. Sir Abraham listened in pitying wonder.
"I really think, Mr. Harding, you had better wait for the Archdeacon. This is a most serious step. One for which, in my opinion, there is not the slightest necessity. And as you have done me the honour of asking my advice, I must implore you to do nothing without the approval of your friends. A man is never the best judge of his own position."
"A man is the best judge of what he feels himself. I'd sooner beg my bread till my death than read such another article as those two that have appeared, and feel, as I do, that the writer has truth on his side."
"Have you not a daughter, Mr. Harding?" "An unmarried daughter?"
"I have," said he, now standing also, but still playing away on his fiddle with his hand behind his back. "I have, Sir Abraham, and she and I are completely agreed on this subject."
"Pray excuse me, Mr. Harding, if what I say sounds impertinent, but surely it is you that should be prudent on her behalf. She is young and does not know the meaning of living on an income of £160 a year. On her account, give up this idea. Believe me, it is sheer quixotism."
The warden walked away to the window, and then back to his chair, and then, irresolute as to what to say, took another turn to the window. The Attorney-General was really extremely patient, but he was beginning to think that the interview had been long enough. "But if this income be not justly mine, what if she and I have both to beg? If so, it would be better to beg."
"My dear sir, nobody now questions its justness."
"Yes, Sir Abraham, one does question it, the most important of all witnesses against me. I question it myself. My God knows whether or no I love my daughter, but I would sooner that she and I should both beg than that she should live in comfort on money which is truly the property of the poor. It may seem strange to you, Sir Abraham, it is strange to myself, that I should have been 10 years in that happy home and not have thought of these things till they were so roughly dinned into my ears. I cannot boast of my conscience when it required the violence of a public newspaper to awaken it. But now that it is awake, I must obey it. When I came here, I did not know that the suit was withdrawn by Mr. Bold, and my object was to beg you to abandon my defence. As there is no action, there can be no defence. But it is at any rate as well that you should know that from tomorrow I shall cease to be the warden of the hospital. My friends and I differ on this subject, Sir Abraham, and that adds much to my sorrow, but it cannot be helped." And as he finished what he had to say, he played up such a tune as had never before graced the chambers of any Attorney-General. He was standing up, gallantly fronting Sir Abraham, and his right arm passed with bold and rapid sweeps before him, as though he were embracing some huge instrument which allowed him to stand thus erect. And with the fingers of his left hand he stopped with preternatural velocity a multitude of strings, which ranged from the top of his collar to the bottom of the lapel of his coat. Sir Abraham listened and looked in wonder, as he had never before seen Mr. Harding. The meaning of all these wild gesticulations was lost upon him, but he perceived that the gentleman who had a few minutes since been so subdued as to be unable to speak without hesitation was now impassioned, nay, almost violent.
"You'll sleep on this, Mr. Harding, and tomorrow—"
"I have done more than sleep upon it," said the warden. "I have lain awake upon it, and that night after night. I found that I could not sleep upon it. Now I hope to do so." The Attorney-General had no answer to make to this, so he expressed a quiet hope that whatever settlement was finally made would be satisfactory, and Mr. Harding withdrew, thanking the great man for his kind attention. Mr. Harding was sufficiently satisfied with the interview to feel a glow of comfort as he descended into the small old square of Lincoln's Inn. It was a calm, bright, beautiful night, and by the light of the moon even the chapel of Lincoln's Inn and the sombre row of chambers which surround the quadrangle looked well. He stood still a moment to collect his thoughts, and reflect on what he had done and was about to do. He knew that the Attorney-General regarded him as little better than a fool, but that he did not mind. He and the Attorney-General had not much in common between them. He knew also that others, whom he did care about, would think so too. But Eleanor, he was sure, would exult in what he had done, and the bishop, he trusted, would sympathise with him. In the meantime, he had to meet the Archdeacon, and so he walked slowly down Chancery Lane and along Fleet Street, feeling sure that his work for the night was not yet over. When he reached the hotel, he rang the bell quietly and with a palpitating heart. He almost longed to escape round the corner and delay the coming storm by a further walk round St. Paul's Churchyard, but he heard the slow creaking shoes of the old waiter approaching, and he stood his ground manfully. End of chapter 17.